The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to Between the Synapse with Mark Tobin. If you're looking to learn something useful, you've come to the wrong place. But as Belushi once said, it don't cost nothing. So, let's get things started. Here's Mark Tobin.
Welcome to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. Today is part three of our three-part series focusing on education. Today, we seek to understand how schools can best educate children who exhibit challenging behavior or learning issues. We're joined by two well-established women in this field. The first is Jessica Minahan. She is a board-certified behavioral analyst and co-author with Nancy Rappaport of The Behavior Code, Companion Strategies, Tools, and Interventions for Supporting Students with Anxiety-Related or Oppositional Behaviors. This is a new book that incorporates their years of experience supporting students to reveal a real systematic approach for deciphering causes and patterns of difficult student behaviors. Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi is an experienced political strategist. She is founder, CEO, and president of Respectability USA, a national nonprofit, nonpartisan organization whose mission is to reshape the attitudes of American society so that people with disabilities can more fully participate in and contribute to society. Respectability USA can be found at just that, respectabilityusa.com. And if you want to learn more about Jessica or find out how to buy her book, go to www.jessicaminahan.com. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Really appreciate it. This is a subject which I think has been long discussed, but at times probably long ignored. And so just before we get started, thank both of you for the work that you do in this very important area. Jessica, your book, first of all, was highly readable. And what I really liked about it was how it laid out concrete techniques for teaching educational instructors on how to teach challenging students. It was very specific, and it seemed to be approachable. The first question I have, and this really goes for both of you, but Jessica, if you could address this first, is how do you define challenges as you go about your work?
Well, I think that the literature states that our teachers are leaving the field within the first 5 years in large numbers. And the number one reason for that, indicated by surveys, is student challenging behavior. And tend to be kids who have disruptive behavior, kids who are disrespectful in class, acting out, and also kids who are shutting down, crying, avoiding school, a myriad of behaviors that, unfortunately, teachers are having a hard time meeting their needs. And what's happening in our schools is there's a large gap between teacher education and the challenges that children are facing right now. So, for example, in master's degree programs, general ed teachers, elementary and secondary, are only mandated to take 0 to 1 classes in behavior management and 0 to 1 in mental health. But in a given classroom, about 25% of the classroom can have mental health disabilities, so which present in erratic kind of behaviors and some of these challenging behaviors like I mentioned. So these poor teachers, there was a large hole in the research and the literature that not only address it in general, but translating it into practical strategies for a teacher and translating this complex mental health information into a strategy a teacher can do easily.
Now, Jennifer, this is your second nonprofit organization, which you have actually founded. I understand that Respectability's mission is a bit wider, and particularly how you define the challenges that you're looking to assist?
This is a very interesting topic because the idea of education is to prepare us to be better citizens, better employees, better people. And if somebody has a different behavior or a different learning style, it can really impact their entire life, and it can impact all the people around them for their entire lifespan. So this issue is very important. I'm really glad that you're doing this conversation. A lot of the reasons that people have a behavior in a classroom is because they're frustrated, and sometimes they're frustrated because they have a disability. Over 12% of the students in public school today have some sort of disability. It might be that they're on the autism spectrum and they have some difficulty making friends or reading social cues. It may be that they have a hearing or a vision difference. It may be a physical difference, and it may be that they're dyslexic. So they may be having tremendous difficulty accessing the curriculum. And so getting the right diagnosis and getting the right interventions early is very important so that you can eliminate the frustrations and the child can have a positive educational experience from day one.
And Jessica, what you do is once you know what the issues are, you suggest the techniques that are in your book, Behavioral Code, in order to help teachers teach to these kids. And you focus on K through 6, I think, for the reason that Jennifer laid out, which is if these issues aren't addressed early on, those kids are going to have lifelong issues.
Yes. In fact, I think about behavior as a form of communication, just like Jennifer was saying. So when you think about that and sort of get curious about behavior, what is this child communicating? And think about behavior as a symptom. When you dig under behavior, almost always it's due to an underdeveloped skill, either in learning, a social skill, self-regulation, for example, is a skill we can teach children so they don't get so upset when they're frustrated. So I think of myself as a translator. I'll go into classrooms and say to the teacher, you speak English, but I speak behavior. And what this child really is trying to tell us is, I'm struggling here, this is too hard. And that lends ourselves to a more productive sort of conversation. But we do risk very much having children miss big chunks of their learning due to these disabilities that are under-addressed. So, for example, if a child was anxious, it's very hard to learn and be anxious at the same time. Like, for example, if you just realized, you reached down your pocket and you realized you didn't have your cell phone anymore. Oh my gosh, where's my cell phone?
Day's
you probably
over.
Won't be able to listen to anything I was saying for the next 5 minutes because anxiety sort of trumps learning. So if we don't address that and keep the child from getting too nervous and frustrating them and overwhelming them, they're going to miss big pieces of education. And we do see, like Jennifer mentioned, kids with big gaps in their learning going forward, which is obviously a major problem to become productive adults.
Jennifer, I know that your group looks at institutional and governmental roadblocks to being able to provide the kinds of services that Jessica is talking about. What do you see as the main issues or the main roadblocks that you face in ensuring that all kids will have the kind of teaching instruction that's going to make them a successful student and eventually a successful adult?
Well, one of the things, Mark, that's really important is to have high expectations for every child. Unfortunately, we don't always see those high expectations. Sometimes it's because the parents aren't giving the right expectations and supports to their own children. Maybe it's a single family. Maybe the parent doesn't have a strong educational background themselves. Maybe it's because they have a disability and people have sort of written them off. When a child is young, if they have a significant difference that's a disability, by the time they're a toddler, they have legal access to free public service from the government. It's called an infant and toddler program that can come in, they can evaluate your toddler, they can start providing free services in your home. It might be speech therapy, it might be occupational or physical therapy,
to help your child fill the gaps that they need to be school ready. One thing that's unfortunate is that in some areas, unfortunately, when those kids are being diagnosed and they're getting those supports, the parents are being told, well, your child has this or that disability and therefore will qualify for government benefits. And I think the most important thing for you is to sign your child up for benefits so that they can basically sit on the couch and collect checks their whole life. But the fact is that times have changed tremendously, and things that were real barriers to work before are no longer barriers. For example, an individual who is blind today because of assisted technology with screen readers on computers usually can read faster than I can. I have a coworker who's blind. He reads 200 words a minute because the app on his computer reads to him that quickly. I can't even understand the words that are being spoken by his computer, but he understands 200 words a minute and he retains it all. It's tremendous. There's so many different changes that people who previously were thought that they couldn't accomplish a lot are now becoming superstars. So we have to set very high expectations for children for the beginning, and then you can train them for those positive outcomes. And I think that Jessica talks about the importance of positive behavioral supports to make sure that if a child isn't succeeding appropriately or isn't behaving, that you're not just saying no, no, no. Instead, you're setting achievable goals and you're saying to them yes and congratulations when they have a success. And the positive feedback encourages them to get more positive feedback, which can give you the outcomes that you want in terms of great behavior and wonderful academic achievement. It's not always easy. Sometimes you have to do it step by step. That's really the way to achieve the goal.
And Jessica, like Jennifer said, the advancements that can help with children with challenges to learn better is the reason that you wrote your book. And it has a lot of innovative techniques, which I assume, you know, some are time-tested, some are probably newer. But you call it, the name of the book is Behavior Code, and the first chapter is called Breaking the Code. First of all, what is the code? How do you define it? And can you talk about your FAIR plan?
Sure. And in the first book, The Behavior Code, I co-wrote with Nancy Rappaport, who's a child psychiatrist. And this book that is coming out is called The Behavior Code Companion, that I wrote on my own to sort of go in more depth. And what the breaking the behavior code really means is, why is a child behaving this way? And answering the why really helps us pick interventions that will work. I really try to talk about not making assumptions about behavior and really going more systematically into the why. So, for example, a lot of us have tried to say calm down to a child who's crying or screaming, right? And I've rarely seen that work. Just saying calm down doesn't usually work.
And by the way, all these new stickers about calm down and, you know, do the laundry, calm down and drink a soda, I don't think either.
Not so much for a kid with a mental health disability. You know, and some parents scream, calm down the stairs at the kids downstairs. That doesn't work either. But that's an example of a behavior plan really needing to target a skill deficit. So I really emphasize teaching self-calming. So, for example, a lot of our kids who are acting out don't have that skill. So one really easy way to do that is to practice it, just like you would practice math or reading. For example, if there's a beanbag area, a little comfy reading nook in the back of a kindergarten classroom, the little kid can go back to the corner and practice self-calming when they're nice and calm and they can listen and learn the skill. And if you do that a couple times a week, repetitively, and that's all he does when he's sitting in that beanbag, then when he's upset and you say, okay, it's time to go to the beanbag and calm down, now he knows what you're saying, and he has the skill to start engaging in things that will actually calm him and to do it. So I really think, you know, figuring out what are the skill deficits that are leading to the child acting, being overwhelmed by anxiety or frustration and acting in a certain way, and then targeting those skills is really breaking the code.
Jessica's absolutely right, Mark. You really have to look for the clues. And sometimes a mistake people make is they think that one thing that they find is the only challenge that they're facing. So I'll give you an example. Let's imagine that you have a child who's acting differently because they don't hear totally correctly. They've got a hearing challenge, and so they're not hearing all the directions in the classroom. They're not getting all the content, which is very frustrating. And then there's a diagnosis that they have a hearing challenge, and they think, well, that's the only challenge. Well, what if the child is also dyslexic? Or what if the child also has executive function disorder, which means that basically it's hard for them to organize their thoughts, organize their things, and giving them too many instructions one after another without letting them achieve some of those things before you move on to the next set of instructions. Maybe they have that as well. So I think it's quite common what we see with kids is that if they have a physical disability, maybe they have a hearing difference or they've had a stroke or they have cerebral palsy or they're blind, whatever the physical disability is, people sort of focus on that physical thing that they can see and they forget the thing that they can't see, which might be the executive function disorder. It might be a mental health or an anxiety disorder. It might be an eating disorder. That you have to be sure to look for all the clues. And don't think that when you've unlocked one issue that you necessarily have all the things that you need to be aware of.
And that's why the teacher training is so important to this overall effort. I know, Jessica, you touched on this in terms of teacher training and what they're required to take. But how practical is it? Well, let me ask you this first. How deep does the kinds of training techniques that we're talking about go in terms of the educational system? Are they sporadic in certain districts that perhaps may be a little bit more sophisticated? Are these still considered innovative experiences? Or are we talking about a widespread acceptance of these kinds of teaching techniques?
Well, I think what Jennifer said was right, that when it's an invisible disability, it's the most challenging for school systems. So autism is largely invisible, and mental health is definitely invisible. I think that schools are taking on a lot of initiatives. They're taking core knowledge is a big initiative right now. There's, you know, technology-infused education is usually a big initiative. So social-emotional learning to this group of teachers who have not been trained in it sometimes is in the back burner in terms of the list of initiatives for school systems. Yet when we look at some of the national statistics, that there's a big study in 2011 that 30% of children with emotional behavioral disorders, only 30% are employed as adults, 58% arrested, 48% dropping out of high school between ages 9 through 12. Another symptomatic statistic is that twice as many kids with disabilities are suspended in this country as opposed to children who don't have disabilities. And that's another symptom to me that our systems need this support, and these are the children that are struggling. And ironically,
all right, Jessica, if you can just hold that thought, we've got to take a quick break, but okay. We'll be back with Jessica Minahan and Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi in just a couple minutes on Between the Synapse.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Ah, a nice glass of wine is very refreshing after the end of a long day. But have you ever considered the story behind the wine? Tune in to Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio with your hosts, Roger and Donna Beery. You'll meet some of the people behind the world's wineries, travel the wine country, and learn more about that glass that you're enjoying. Roger and Donna will also give would-be vintners a behind-the-scenes look at starting a winery. Bacchus and Beery Wine Radio airs live every Friday at 1 p.m. Pacific, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on Voice America Variety.
Tired of lackluster results with your marketing? Craving more leads in your business? Tune into the Mojo Marketing Edge with the team behind Mojo Global Marketing, Ira Rosen and Corey Michael Sanchez. Winners of the Marketer of the Year, they will show you how to generate daily leads, build databases of raving fans, and close deals faster than ever before. See what's hot right now and how you can tap into it to generate an endless supply of customers and clients. The Mojo Marketing Edge can be heard every Monday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Between the Synapse. We are talking to Jessica Minahan, who is the author of The Behavior Code Companion, which can be found on Harvard Education Press or by going to jessicaminahan.com. And we're also talking to Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi, who is the CEO and president of Respectability USA, which you can find at respectabilityusa.org. We are talking about how schools can implement the techniques and the challenges that that many of these schools face. Do you have, either of you, have any idea of what percentage of public schools are, would you consider well-versed to appropriately educate the kinds of challenges we're talking about?
I don't know if I have a percentage, but I do know that in teacher surveys, it's one of the top three concerns of teachers is their lack of training. So I think that even schools who are taking it on could use even more. I think one of the issues is that, particularly for the group of kids with mental health, translating the theoretical, clinical, pedagogical information that's out there about kids with mental health, like an anxiety disorder, very few pieces of literature are translating that into what can a teacher do when the child says no or screams no. You know, how do I respond well? What we tend to do in schools is a very traditional approach, which is based in motivation. So we'll say to a kid, if you get your homework done every day this week, you can earn extra recess time. Or, you know what, start your math, get your math work done, or you don't get to go out to recess, that kind of thing. And for a kid with mental health or any disability, it's really not a motivation problem. It's not that he won't. It's that he can't behave in that moment.
It's not that they don't want more recess. It's that they can't find their way to it. Jennifer, what about from your viewpoint?
Look, I'm going to speak from the perspective of somebody who was a behavior problem myself. When I was a kid, first of all, I'm highly dyslexic. I could not read until I was 12. And I also stopped growing when I was 12, and I'm almost 5'11". So I was this giant of a kid that was illiterate, and I couldn't do math because I had an undiagnosed learning disability. And so when you're in a situation like that, your self-esteem is terrible because you take tests and you do terribly, and you see the other kids succeeding and you're doing terribly, and other kids start to pick on you and bully you, and it's incredibly frustrating. And so it's important to help kids be diagnosed when they're very young if they have a learning difference. I mean, I went on to be able to you know, graduate and you know, be on the dean's list at Emory, which is a very fine college, and to,
it's an absolutely great college, by the way.
You know, to do other things. But it took a long time to get to where I needed to be. And so ultimately, you have to understand that these kids really deeply inside, they want to succeed. And if they're having behavior issues, it's exactly as Jessica said, it's because there's a disconnect, there's a frustration, there's something that's not working. So you have to sort of take a pause button and say, what is the mystery that we need to solve, is exactly as Jessica said, and then go about solving it and then doing it step by step. I mean, really, it's very painful for a child when they're not succeeding. Very, very painful. And they really want to do well. So you have to give them the support. But the other thing is that it can't just be the teachers. Can't just be the schools. The teachers, by and large, there's 25 kids in a class. There's a lot of demands. As Jessica said, there's the new core curriculum in most states. There's also the new technology in the classroom. So the parents have to be really on it. Now, one of the things that's really good is that because of the technology, in most classrooms today, they're emailing parents a lot of information about how their kids are doing. So you can see what their scores are on their homework and what their scores are on their tests and whether they turned in their homework. And you can really be on top of it with your child. So it's very important for the parents to be very, very active. I myself am a parent, and every day you have to check the computer site and see what's the homework that your kids have to do and how is it going, and to really engage in that conversation over the dinner table. What are you learning about in school today? What's going well for you? What's going less well? What can we do about it? And to talk to the teachers. So there really is a process, and the parents have to play a very, very important role.
All right, well, let me ask y'all about this question. You know, when I went to school, elementary school in particular, and it was quite some time ago, there was special ed. And everybody knew there were kids in special ed, and you would see them occasionally, but they weren't integrated, and they were highly stigmatized. I guess what some of the, we don't call them critics or naysayers might say, is that the better approach is to put the kids who are having challenges in a separate classroom so that the kids who can go at the regular speed won't be held back.
So there have been a number of studies about this, because a lot of people really thought that that was true, that for a, let's say you have a future Nobel laureate in the classroom, is their learning going to be slowed down by Johnny, who has a cognitive disability and is having a trouble keeping up? And what you find is that in the schools that are good schools, where they sort of break down the learning at the appropriate level for the kids, that there is no slowdown for the Nobel laureate to be whatsoever, and that in fact the learning becomes even better because it's more conscious, it's more planful. You know, in a classroom today, the good teachers, they already have kids, generally if it's 25 kids in a class, they may have four kids sitting with their desks facing each other with work groups so that they can work in projects, and they may be working at many different levels within the same classroom. So really, it does not slow down your future Nobel Prize winner or your future doctor or lawyer. In fact, what it can do is it can help them appreciate the fact that literally one out of every five Americans has a disability. Literally, that's one out of five. It's the one minority group that people can join at any moment in their life, because one disease and one accident, and you can move from being a temporarily able-bodied person to somebody with a disability overnight, literally. So it's something important for people to be able to understand the diversity of humankind and of American citizens and to embrace it, because all those people will have some ability, some talents, and they need to be able to maximize it. Now, if they have very, very, very significant involvements with their disabilities, and sometimes they are in a special classroom, but that really should be the exception and not the rule.
What do you say, Jessica?
I think a lot of these strategies also, I totally agree with what Jennifer said, and also when we teach kids things like self monitoring and self-regulation, meaning, am I being appropriate right now? Am I going too fast? Am I going too slow? I'm not going to finish my paper before the bell. Those are skills of self-regulation and self-monitoring. Paul Tough just wrote a book, How Children Succeed, which was an excellent book, and he outlined, he did a study of very high socioeconomic kids in very privileged private schools, as well as kids who were struggling in Harlem public schools, and compared them. And the kids who are dropping out of college all are lacking the same list of skills, despite their socioeconomic background. So there's a universal design, meaning it's good for everybody to teach skills like self-regulation. So, for example, if I promote a skill, a trick called self-check. So instead of telling a child 500 directions, like a child with ADHD who moves around a lot, instead of saying, sit up, buddy, oh, pick your head up, stop tapping your pencil, okay, you're supposed to be working, you know, a teacher will give 1,000 directions. And the problem with that is the child's a passive participant in that, and he'll follow the direction but not really learn much. If you change that, same effort from the teacher, and say, okay, everyone do a self-check. Are you on task? Do you need help? Are you sitting appropriately? And now have the child look down and sort of read themselves and look at their own behavior clues. Am I doing the right thing right now? So some kids will get the feedback, oh, I am, and that will help with self-esteem and learn appropriate behavior. And some kids will say, oh, wait a minute, I'm upside down and my pencil's in my ear. I better switch that. And so they're starting to learn to read their own behavior cues and self-monitor, which, of course, is what we really pray for with all our teens and our kids in college. So there's a universal design to having kids with disabilities in our classrooms because it's good for everybody.
And Jennifer, how do you measure, I'm sorry, Jessica, how do you measure the success of the programs that you seek to have implemented in the various schools?
Well, I'm a data person because I'm a behavior geek. So I think we want to see progress. So we take a little bit of data, you know, how is this child, how much work is he producing, for example, or how many incidents or times is he sent to the principal's office, things like that. And if that's, you know, those are looking better by the end of the year, that's progress. How is the teacher's stress level working with this child? Those are kinds of the litmus tests I take to see progress. And it really is, this time of year, I love doing trainings in schools because it should be a front-loading sort of push, that the more we do in September and October, setting routines and teaching some of these skills in February and March and April, we have a class that has more time on task and more learning, and we should have a smoother year towards the end of the year.
And Jennifer,
let me jump in there, because this is really important. You really can collect a lot of data, and this is really a terrific thing to do, because generally if a child has behavioral challenges, there may be many things that the child is doing that are not what we'd call quote-unquote expected behaviors. And so let's say the kid is fidgeting. Let's say the kid isn't finishing their work on time. Let's say the kid is, speaking when they shouldn't speak. They have a whole list of things you'd like to, quote-unquote, fix about what the child is doing. Some people are tempted to say to the child, behave, and that should encompass everything. But that's really not the way to go. You need to target the things that they're doing frequently that are particularly challenging and deal with them one at a time. So usually what you see is a behavior chart, and the behavior chart will target one or two of the behaviors. It'll be, you know, Johnny will sit still for, you know, more than X amount of time in a row, or, you know, Johnny will raise his hand before he blurts out a question or an answer. And you only deal with a couple of the targeted behaviors at a time, and you literally reward the child with stickers or with tickets or with something, and then they can earn something every couple of days or once a week by having good behavior. And what you see is these positive behavioral supports, they really, really work because the child will want to achieve, you know, that little prize. They'll want to achieve, you know, the gold stars, and they'll stop doing whatever the problem behavior is that you're working on at first. And once you have that set of behaviors under control, then you can move on to the next set of behaviors. It takes a little longer than trying to, say, behave and expecting that overnight they're going to behave on a whole range of issues, but it actually works, and it actually is lasting, and it can be very, very successful.
And Jennifer, I think it was Jessica that talked about private schools. I know the Respectability USA has looked into elite private schools who don't frequently welcome children with disabilities. What have you found, and have you had any success in changing that?
So this is an excellent question, Mark. This is really important because, first of all, as I mentioned, one out of every five Americans has a disability. But one thing that's particularly important is that most American employers don't want to hire people with disabilities, and therefore, fully 70% of working-age Americans with disabilities are not in the workforce. That means that a huge number of them are literally sitting on a couch at home, living off of government benefits, which, by the way, are terrible benefits, so that they're living really in poverty, and they're in isolation. They're not able to participate in our society in a fulfilling way because people in America, we love to work. We want to contribute to something. We want to achieve the American dream, but people are not giving them a chance. Now, a lot of hiring is done by elites, by people who are CEOs of companies, by people who make public policy, and those elites, the CEOs, the, you know, sort of 1% of America, a lot of them go to these elite private schools. And so it's important when they're young for them to get formative experiences to see that people with disabilities are a part of our society and really want to contribute and can succeed. Because, you know, you have these tremendous people with disabilities that have achieved great things, like Ernst & Young, this wonderful American company. Young was deaf. You look at, you know, Stephen Hawking, who's a great scientist who uses a wheelchair because he has ALS. You look at, you know, many, many people like Einstein, who probably was on the autism spectrum. There are people with disabilities who are super achievers, and yet most elite private schools will not accept and serve and welcome kids with disabilities. So this is a problem for those kids with disabilities who don't get to go to the Sidwell Friends School where President Obama's children went and where President Clinton's children went. They literally, I mean, their head of school literally told me that they do not accept those kids, that they do not have those kids at that school. They don't welcome them. So that means that, A, the kids with disabilities don't get the opportunity. Maybe they're exceptionally bright but happen to be blind or deaf. Could totally do the curriculum but not given the chance. So they lose out from not being able to go to those schools. But I think the far bigger damage is that the kids without the disabilities never get the normative experience of seeing that people with disabilities can also achieve and have abilities too.
All right, we've got to take a break. When we come back, Jennifer, maybe you could address your ideas for changing that. So stick around on Between the Synapses.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com.
Boomers Rock Radio with Tom Mack is ready to entertain, enlighten, and educate. Our show is all about quality of life, fitness, mental health, nutrition, self-improvement, finance, and more. As you grow older, you may actually have more questions. Tom is here to help. He'll invite experts from many facets of health, business, and life to bring the answers to you. Make Boomers Rock Radio your weekly stop on the Voice America Variety Channel every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific. Join us and improve your life.
If you are interested in real estate in America's largest city or anywhere, be sure to listen for Good Morning New York Real Estate with Vince Rocco Although our focus is on Manhattan and other real estate markets in and around New York City, we'll have plenty of information that will help you successfully buy, sell, and close a transaction no matter where you are in the world. Good Morning New York, Real Estate with Vince Rocco can be heard every Tuesday at 9 a.m. in New York, 6 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit Facebook.com/Voice America.
You are listening to Between the Synapse with your host, Mark Tobin. If you want in on this week's discussion, please call us at 1-866-472-5788. That's 1-866-472-5788. You may also send an email to mbt@betweenthesynapse.com or on Twitter at @BetweenTSynapse. Now, back to the show.
All right, and welcome back to Between the Synapse. We are talking about educating kids with learning challenges with Jessica Minahan, as well as Jennifer Laszlo Mizrahi. Jennifer, before the break, you talked about barriers for kids with learning challenges to attending some of the elite private schools around the country. What is Respectability USA proposing in order to change that?
Well, we have written to the top schools, and there really are top feeder schools. They're the schools that the kids that graduate go on to Harvard and Yale and Stanford, and we've written to them, and we've asked them to be more inclusive of people with disabilities, both in their student population and in their faculty. And we've given them a lot of tips and tools for how they can do that. By the way, some people wrongfully think that it's going to be very expensive to do, and in many cases, there's really no cost involved. It's a bit of training. It might be a bit of learning. It might mean that the child comes in with their own computer if they're blind, so that they can use the the assisted technology on the computer for their reading, for example. But a lot of people mistakenly think there's going to be huge cost involved, and generally there is not. So helping to take away some of the barriers from the misinformation and try and fill the gaps with information. We've seen some schools, for example, Phillips, which is a really high caliber prep school in America, they sent me a letter. I'm pleased to report that Phillips Academy has made a conscious effort to be thoughtful and proactive with respect to welcoming otherwise qualified individuals into our community. See, this is the key. We're not asking them to accept kids that cognitively can't handle the curriculum, that aren't smart enough to be super achievers academically, because that's who they serve. Is they want to serve kids who are super bright. But there are plenty of kids that are super bright that might also have a disability. They might be dyslexic. They might be blind. They might have Asperger's, but they're still super bright. So there are schools like Andover that are making a concerted effort. Unfortunately, Sidwell is not one of those schools where President Obama sends his children and where President Clinton sent his daughter Chelsea beforehand. So we're trying to just make them more aware. This is going to be, this coming year, the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. 25th anniversary. So it's really a shame that so many of these fine institutions that are training the future leaders of America, people who are going to be the big employers, are still not, being inclusive. If they stopped it, they weren't accepting people because they were black or Hispanic or female, they'd be in big trouble. But they're getting away with denying access to people with differences that are just simple disabilities, things that Jessica can teach them how to handle, and so can many others.
And Jessica, Jennifer mentioned cost, which is always a factor any time that you want to improve something. Even if people agree that, this is the right program, right technique, you'll always find, whether it's school boards or state legislators, whoever provides the funding, saying, yeah, but we just can't afford it. And I know that you can justify it based on the long-term benefits in terms of jobs and being productive adults. But is this something that you face, when you go around the country that you see as a consistent issue? And if so, what do you say in light of it?
Yes, it is a consistent issue, and it can be terribly frustrating for parents and for educators. I'm in different areas of the country. I'm in consulting to El Centro, California, which is a city right on the Mexican border. And some of the classrooms there can be up to 40 students and one teacher. And the population of kids there tend to have sort of a generational trauma anxiety profile. And so it feels very overwhelming for one teacher with that many kids with a lot of mental health issues condensed in one school. And yes, they could use some teaching assistants, and they could use psychologists in every building, but the funds just aren't there. And so in the short term, we really try to educate the teacher with as much strategies as possible, but the advocacy really is at the top. So we'll meet with superintendents and so forth that if we don't put the investment in the social-emotional learning and safety of some of the kids, that we won't even really get to math and reading, which is what happens if a teacher is disrupted and there are a lot of behavior problems in a classroom. It can disrupt learning for everybody, which is the fear people have about inclusion. But inclusion, I would say, is very easy to do poorly. And part of it is supporting it economically as well.
And when you have these conversations with superintendents, you know, I'm sure they acknowledge the problem and they say, oh, we, you know, we'd love to do this. But, you know, do you find that they're more likely to actually try to solve the cost issues? Or is it mostly they throw up their hands and say, you know, this is what we got?
I think, unfortunately, a lot of systems do the Band-Aid approach instead of thinking, you know, in early intervention, if we really focused and put more counselors and more training for teachers in the early levels, by the time they get to middle school, these children have skills, like I've been saying. They can wait, which means delayed gratification, so they don't need everything right now. They can calm down. They can start to self-monitor. Am I doing the right thing, even when teachers aren't around to tell me? When they have those skills by middle school, we're going to have a much more educational-friendly environment in the middle school and high school, where behavior problems get bigger and start to maybe even become a little bit criminal, that kind of thing. So, unfortunately, you know, some school systems are doing that and some school systems are not. At the national level, there's really few incentives to be proactive right now in terms of kids with social-emotional supports.
Now, Jennifer, your organization monitors Washington and looks at solutions, you know, through the legislative process. You know, I suppose one of the challenges that your organization faces is that while there are a lot of parents who want to see the various changes and increases in funding, it's not like the lobbies that you see, you know, walking the halls in Washington that are very well funded or that, you know, have the immediate pulse of the American public and can garner a lot of attention with just one incident, perhaps like we, you know, we've seen something with the NFL recently. Number one, what is on y'all's legislative agenda? And two, what's the key from your perspective in order to be successful in pursuing changes to the law and additional funding for the kinds of programs that Jessica illuminated?
Well, Mark, that's an excellent question. I think the biggest misnomer is that it takes more money to do the job right. Because, in fact, if you do the right job, you're going to save a lot of tax money. I'm going to give you an example. So today, fully 12% of federal expenditures, that's 12% of our federal tax dollars, are spent on benefits for people with disabilities who are not in the workforce but are working age. 12%. That is,
I'm sorry, 12% of our entire budget?
12%. It's this huge amount of money. It is literally over $400 billion a year that is being spent on different benefits for people with disabilities who are largely not working. And so 70% of Americans with disabilities are not working. So one of the most important things you can do is to fix things in the school systems and fix the transition to work. I'm going to give you a very specific example. Let's take a young person with Down syndrome or who has an intellectual disability. So maybe they have a pretty low IQ. Maybe their IQ is 80. Well, some people will tell that young person or their parents, you know what, you're never going to work. You're never going to amount to anything. You're going to live on benefits. And so that person gets frustrated because they're not investing in them to enable them to do their best. And so they become a behavior problem in the classroom, which disrupts other people. They can have all kinds of supports legally through something called an IEP, an Individualized Education Program, and they can legally stay in school until they're 21 years old. Literally, in school till they're 21, even if they're never going to achieve more than a second or third grade reading level. But what we've seen in some states, particularly in Wisconsin, for example, is that the last year of school, when they've still legally been able to get services, instead of going to the classroom, they're enabling them to have job opportunities through a program called Project Search. There's now 270 Project Search sites across America. The graduates of Project Search, on average, 7 out of 10 of their graduates are going into competitive workforce. In other words, that same young person who may have the IQ of 80, because they spent an entire year working at a hospital or working at a retirement home or working at a hotel, learning real job experience, which might be food prep in a kitchen, it might be housekeeping, it might be scanning documents. But because they're able to do that, they're now able to get a job. For every one of those kids who we can help get a job who doesn't go into the benefit system, we're going to save a minimum of $380,000 in tax money just for their benefits. That is the cash payments, not including their Medicare or Medicaid payments. So you can save huge amounts of money by doing a better infant and toddler program, by doing better training for the teachers, by telling the kids from day one, we have an employment first outcome goal for you that we think that you can succeed, and we know that other people just like you have succeeded in the past and have done a great job for their employers. And we see many, many employers are discovering that these individuals can be loyal, successful, and fabulous employees to make their organizations better and stronger.
It's certainly the case is there in terms of, you know, cost analysis, but I assume that there's still, you know, roadblocks, you know, particularly with the climate in Washington today.
Clearly there are roadblocks, but shockingly, Washington did something really smart this year. It eliminated 16 programs at the federal level that were completely failing to deliver any results in terms of jobs for people with disabilities. They eliminated these programs. Now, every single governor across the United States of America must come up with a brand new comprehensive strategy to improve the performance metrics so that people with disabilities in their states can actually be work ready and that employers can be ready to invite them into the workforce so that they can be more self-sufficient, able to really, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. You know, this is, you know, it's time to stop giving people fish and time to start enabling them to fish on their own. And a lot of it has to do with ending the stigma, because there's a bad rep on people with disabilities who can do a great job. And that really trickles all the way down to, you know, really not investing in them adequately in their school years. So they're not getting the supports that Jessica talked about, which are so very, very important. So this is now changing across the country. Every governor has 11 months left with which to come up with their plans. So it's a good time to contact your governor and say, Governor, are you getting serious about this plan? Are you really doing it like they're doing it in Wisconsin and in Delaware, in Mississippi and some other states? Or are you really waiting around and letting things overtake? I'll have to say that your state of Texas is one state where we have not seen the governor be particularly active on this, and we've not seen.
You had to go there. You had to bring it up, did you?
We haven't seen Texas be particularly active on this, and we haven't seen either candidate for governor be particularly active on this either.
Well, Jessica, listen, we only have a couple minutes left. First of all, I want to correct something. Jessica, I combined two of your books into one. You should get credit for writing two books. One was The Behavior Code, which you co-wrote, and the new book, which is out this year, is The Behavior Code Companion, which you wrote on your own. So I apologize for that that I talked about at the beginning of the show. But real quick, in about 30 seconds, what's been the response so far to your new book?
Well, I think teachers have been relieved. I get emails all the time saying, thank you, this is what I was looking for, because they know it's not going well. And unfortunately, these poor teachers and administrators are doing their best guess, what we traditionally do with behavior. Here, if you sit down, you get a little token and a sticker chart. Those kinds of things are not enough in terms of teaching these underdeveloped skills, like the skill of waiting and self-regulating. And so what I've found is teachers are relieved and thirsty for more. How do I do this in a busy classroom? I was a classroom teacher first, so I didn't write anything that isn't easy to do in a busy classroom, and teachers really appreciate that.
All right. And Jennifer, real quick, I know that your organization has grown leaps and bounds since you started. What's next?
Well, we really hope that constituents who care about these issues will contact their governors. So you can go to our website, which is www.respectabilityusa.org, and find out more about how to be involved and how to connect to your governor. But it's also important for Hollywood to start showing characters in their shows that show the diversity of talents that, you know, can really come to being successful in America. We have to stop pitying people with disabilities and see them for the abilities that they have. When you see and imagine a better future, then you can create it.
Well, that's a good line to end on. I want to thank you both for appearing on Between the Synapse, and also thank you both again for all the work that you do on behalf of children and others who face learning challenges, which can be, with the right technique, with the right concerns and the right care, be overcome. Thank you for listening to Between the Synapse. I want to thank my Voice America team and my producer, Winston Price. I want to remind you can download the podcast for this and other shows at BetweenTheSynapse.com under BTS Radio headline. Also, check Between the Synapse out on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening, and join us next week on Between the Synapse.
Thanks again for joining us this week. Mark Tobin and Between the Synapse will transmit once again next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. And remember, you never know what lies between the synapse.